This is Law and Disorder.
Today on Law and Disorder, we'll talk about the conflict in Syria and U.S. foreign policy.
Are we getting the full truth here in the United States? Hear what Glenn Ford of Black Agenda Report thinks.
We'll also hear an excerpt from a speech by Phyllis Bennis at the Russell Tribunal on Palestine. We talk with attorney Deb LaBelle on the issue of sentencing children to life in prison without the possibility of parole.
Two cases challenging life without parole were argued in the Supreme Court. We'll hear about that and with what's happening in Michigan, the state with the second most children serving life without parole.
Stay with us.
New York City attorney and author Michael Smith.
I'm Heidi Boghossian, Executive Director of the National Lawyers Guild.
And I'm Michael Ratner, President Emeritus of the Center for Constitutional Rights.
Thousands of Syrians have died in the escalating conflict between forces loyal to President Bashar al-Assad and those opposing his leadership. Internal power struggles have forced tens of thousands of Syrian refugees into other countries, including Turkey. United Nations-based human rights groups assert that the conflict could represent a threat to world peace. We'll get an update on the situation in Syria, as well as some foreign policy analysis taking place in the current presidential debates of the United States from Glenn Ford. Glenn is founder of the Black Agenda Report and many other media forums. He was a founding member of the Washington chapter of the National Association of Black Journalists, and has spoken at scores of colleges and universities across the country. Welcome, Glenn, to Law and Disorder.
Thanks so much for having me.
And Glenn, I just want to say we're thrilled to have you. I saw you debate on Obama on Democracy Now, and I thought you were great, and you've always been great on international affairs, Libya, U.S. imperialism, et cetera. So it's really a pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you. That was Michael Dyson, and we tried to climb over his wall of words.
I think you did well. Heidi?
Glenn, there's been quite a bit of press recently in the United States painting the opposition in Syria as a legitimate force. How does this fit into U.S. interests?
Well, the United States at this point, and we have to really see a global system that's in crisis, has clearly decided that international law, a body of international law that the United States had so much to do with erecting after World War II, that body of international law is no longer useful or even tolerable to U.S. empire, and it's chucking it all. There is no international legitimacy to what is happening in Syria. There is even less legitimacy than what happened in Libya, thanks to the Chinese and the Russians not going along with this venture as they did with Libya. It is pure aggression. It's an example of what the United States now considers to be its model. It believes that even when it cannot get the Security Council to go along with its plans for regime change, it has alternatives. It can gather in an ad hoc way any volunteer group of nations and pretend that there is international legitimacy to the aggression that they mount. This time it's against Syria. They have enlisted the monetary and military and diplomatic and personnel support of those despots, those criminal families of the Persian Gulf, who believe that all secular regimes in their neighborhood are inherently their enemies, and so they're making a war. Basically, the NATO countries, the United States, and these Gulf kingdoms against Syria. They've also enlisted Turkey. And there is no concept here of the inalienable rights of nations to run their own internal affairs. The United States seems to think that all it has to invoke is they are killing their own people, and that gives the U.S. and any allies it can enlist a blank check to do whatever they want. in terms of having of declaring a no-fly zone, which means declaring war on Syria, in essence, they haven't done that. But the only excuse they offer for not having done that is that Syria does have an air force and does have a passable conventional military, and that might get Americans killed. But the legality or illegality of it does not seem to matter, and it does not matter to the American corporate media. And they're doing the same cheerleading job that they did in Iraq, and then, of course, they were sorry.
I guess so.
For a little while, until the next war came up in Libya. And they jumped in just like the Texas cheerleaders they are, and they cheered that one on.
Let me ask you, let me step back for a second. You mentioned some of the Gulf states. That's Qatar and Saudi Arabia, I know you're referring to, which both supported the Libya overthrow, as well as are supporting giving the money for troops, for arms at least, in Syria. Just give me a sense, in the broad sense, where do you see the U.S. strategic interest in all of this? I mean, I think it's probably obvious, but what's really going on here? Because here you've seen them knock off Iraq. They've knocked off Libya, they being the U.S. They're after Syria. Iran is in their sights. And, of course, they have Israel, their aircraft carrier in the Middle East. So how do you see this unfolding? What's really going on here?
I believe that the United States, or the rulers of the United States, really saw the Arab Spring as potentially an existential crisis, to use the word that the Israelis like to deploy. That is, they looked at the lay of the land in the energy center of the world, and it was full of great question marks that went to the core of their ability to dominate the world. And their first response was to show who was boss with a massive show of military strength against Libya. I don't believe that they intended, until the advent of those events that we call the Arab Spring, to take Colonel Gaddafi out at all. But they had to demonstrate who was boss in the region. And in the process of doing that, they made this alliance. They renewed this alliance with jihadis, the alliance that was first formed in 1979 in Afghanistan. Now they risk doing it again, risking the kind of blowback that we saw from 1979, because they were, in fact, hysterical and desperate at what the events might bring after this Arab Spring. And when they are in that kind of mood, and when they see the world that way, they no longer think just in terms of set pieces and finely tuned outcomes. If they cannot achieve cleanly the kind of regime change that they hope to achieve, they do not hesitate to resort to the imposition of chaos. We have seen that in Africa for the last 50 years, that U.S. policy has been that which we cannot directly control, we will throw into chaos and let millions die in the process. I believe that they have reached that point in the Middle East with the fear that descended on them after the Arab Spring. They will be satisfied with years and years of chaos and social disintegration and great loss of life, as long as it does not result in some kind of reordering of forces that they feel are hostile to their interests.
That's really interesting. I hadn't thought about that at all. I always thought, you know, well, they want to overthrow Libya, and it's not going well for them. But in fact, of course, they overthrew it, and they got exactly what you said, which is chaos now. And they're in the process of Syria as well. And what's interesting to me about Syria, and I just want to see what you make of this, when you read the articles in the Times and otherwise, of course, they, you know, they're very one-sided around human rights violations by the Assad government and not by the, quote, opposition. But one thing that does seem to come out is that the U.S., it claims that it's nervous about arming the opposition in Syria with heavy weapons. Of course, Qatar and Saudi Arabia are doing that because they recognize that they're jihadists. And so what seems to be going on is that what may very well happen in Syria, I'm not sure it will because Assad has a very strong military, is that they're going to wind up with an Afghanistan on their hands. They didn't follow up with the last analysis, but they said the U.S. is nervous about arming jihadists. What do you make of that?
Well, they ought to be nervous. They have made a deal with the devil, that is, folks whose interests and worldview is inimical to imperialism. And let me address that. Muslim fundamentalism behaves very much like a nationalism. It's not a nationalism, but it behaves that way. And if there is any ism that can be relied upon to oppose imperialism, it is a nationalism or a phenomenon that behaves like a nationalism. For these jihadis who have been of use, as Othello said, I have done the state some great service, and they know it. These jihadis have done the U.S. Imperial state some great service, and they do know it, and they do expect, as they do now in Libya, they will expect in Syria, if the regime is brought down, to become a power on the ground. And the United States knows that when that happens, they are going to have fundamental problems writing the ticket in that region. And I think that that is one of the reasons that chaos, just the prolongation of the misery in that region, is a viable option to them.
I know you've been watching the presidential debates. Can you share some of your thoughts on the Obama administration's track record?
This is, I guess, the third one, and one is more disgusting than the other, and I was wondering what was going on in my head. Why am I getting such a sick feeling? And finally, it dawned on me what we are really looking at here. Despite the global financial crisis, despite the near total meltdown of 2008, and we are still, of course, suffering from it unless we are banks, despite all of these economic and resultant social crises, in the United States, we do not have a political crisis. You only have a political crisis, despite the presence of economic and social crisis. You only have a political crisis when there is effective resistance. When there's effective resistance, then the conversation becomes one that is hostile to the order. But we don't have an effective resistance. And so we have this duopoly conversation that we've been observing, the second one between Romney and Obama. And there are no fundamental differences between these people. There is no difference on war. There is no difference on the real burning issues of economy, and that is the dominance of banks over U.S. political life, and as well as economic life. All of these things are part of the consensus, and so we see these little dust-ups off to the side that are made to look like arguments. And I'll be specific. The argument over austerity. There is a consensus on austerity. There's even a number attached to that consensus. And that number was arrived at in 2011, and that's $4 trillion in cuts over 10 years. And Obama was proposing that number. The Republicans had been tossing that same number around. That's also the Simpson-Bowles number, which is an Obama number. And they couldn't get to that grand compromise or grand bargain simply because the Republicans did not want there to even be modest taxes increases on the rich. That is all that separates them. And for the people who are on the receiving end of the axe, that is not a real difference. What do people who are on the receiving end of these $4 trillion in cuts, most of them to what we call people's programs, not the military, should they care if they're going to be cut, if their programs are going to be reduced or done away with? What should they care whether that also entails a few millionaires paying modest increases in taxes? They are left without the programs that are essential to a dignified life. So we see that that in terms of the impact on most people, there's no difference whatsoever between Obama's austerity and the austerity of the Republicans in terms of impact. None at all. And so we get these debates that are really, just a passing of gas in a hermetically sealed consensus room within this Wall Street duopolist party with two factions.
In terms of social activism in this country, if we are to have a Romney administration, do you anticipate a revival of a sort of public outrage and protest?
Since I believe in the United States, there is no possibility of a vibrant progressive movement without the active participation, if not leadership, of Black America, which has historically been the point constituency for change in the United States. If that is the case, and I believe it is so, it is only with the passing on of this Black president that we're going to see such a movement. The advent of a Black in the White House has totally neutralized the Black body politic. It has short-circuited all of our instinctive responses to the travesties wrought by power, since now we believe that we are somehow represented by power in the White House. And as long as that continues, we're not going to have an active Black participation. So I cannot predict that a Romney presidency will automatically set off a progressive movement with active Black participation. But I do believe that such a movement cannot occur while Obama is in office.
In the end, and not that we want to focus on this, because a lot of us either don't vote, or if we vote in New York, we can do whatever we want, because if you want Obama to win, he's going to win in New York no matter what. Remember the last thing they asked you on Democracy Now? Well, you know, you're right about, he didn't say you're right, but Glenn, you have all these really solid points about Obama and Romney being roughly the same on almost every issue you and I can go over. But in the end, are you making the argument that maybe we'd be better off in terms of a people's revolution with Romney in office?
I'm saying that my assessment of Black people's behavior, and based upon 4 years of Black folks' behavior, is that we are not set up to oppose power when it has a Black face. And that since we have historically been the point persons for social change in the United States, it is very unlikely that there will be a truly effective progressive movement without our participation. I'm not afraid of Romney because I don't see any essential differences between he and Obama. I am afraid of what happens when power is unchecked, when that corporate power represented by Obama, as it is represented by Romney, is unchecked. George Bush could not, I believe, have passed a preventive detention bill through Congress. That's why he didn't try.
And I think going to war with Libya, I think, you know, Obama didn't go to Congress to get authority. And you, as you and I have discussed in the past, Glenn, and I don't believe Bush could have gotten away with that.
I don't think so.
I think no one screamed. I was so shocked that he could go to war with Libya without getting congressional consent, even if congressional consent was going to be a rubber stamp, that he didn't even go get the rubber stamp and people weren't screaming, I find to be just appalling.
Yeah, and going beyond Black America, we now know that we didn't have necessarily an anti-war movement. We had an anti-Republican war movement.
I think that's right.
That just disappeared entirely when there was a Democrat in office. What does that tell us about the nature of the American public and the prospects for social change? Now, there are some people who say that the Occupy movement could not have occurred without Obama being in office. I don't see how they come to that conclusion. I think it's almost miraculous that it did occur with Obama in office.
Right, I would agree. Yeah. Do you have any final words to our audience about how you see the next couple of years going out, no matter who wins? You've talked about the Black movement, which I agree, and of course the statistics, which verify what you're saying, on the polling, is 93% of Blacks are in favor of Obama, and 0%, leaving 7 who knows, are in favor of Romney. So you're right about what's happened in the movement in terms of depending on that. But no matter who wins, how do you see the next couple of years unfolding economically, war-wise, and the movement here?
Well, the deterioration of the world financial capitalist order continues apace. It accelerates constantly. We have not come halfway to the end of the saga in Europe, where international capital, fueled, by the way, by these QE1s, 2s, and 3s, which just throws billions of dollars in capital that is not invested in the home market in the United States, is not invested in productive enterprises anywhere, even in the low-wage countries, throws it into the speculative market, and they then mass together these capitalists and these hedge funders and made an attack on the European state itself. Now, that is something of vast historical significance. Just as they seem now to no longer have any perceived stake in international law, which is why they are running roughshod over every convention and treaty and precept of international law, they now seem to have, that is, some sectors of wild capital, seem to have the idea that they don't have any use for the modern nation state anymore. And that's behind their assault in Europe. And I believe that if the only reason that the United States doesn't feel or perceive the brunt of that global attack by capital against existing institutions is that we have so much less than the Europeans have in terms of social structures, of a social safety net, of a welfare state to attack.
That sounds right to me. I have one little clarifying question, then we'll let you go. QE1, QE2, what is that?
The making of free money, and you do it real easy. You don't print it. You just transfer it with the touch of a computer key. You create it in the accounts of the recipient banks. And in this QE3, where you basically give banks money at such nominal interest rates, they can actually make a profit by taking your money and investing in U.S. Treasury bonds. So it's free. It's free money. The QE3 incarnation is now apparently permanent. That is, the U.S. Central Bank, the Federal Reserve, is going to issue $40 billion every month for the purchase of securities for the foreseeable future. This is a permanent bailout of the bad assets of the international banking system. And remember, it's not just U.S. banks that are benefiting from this. The European banks are as well. I believe a fundamental restructuring of the relationship of the state, the United States, and the banks. A permanent free money service that's been created for them, so that they can never become insolvent, no matter what they do, because the Federal Reserve, which is a branch of the U.S. government, the Federal Reserve will continue just to create money for their benefit and issue it to them at absolutely no cost.
Glenn Ford, thank you for being with us. And before you go, can you just give our listeners the information how they can both listen to your radio show as well as go read some of the information that's incredible for people on the Black Agenda Report?
The wonders of the Internet. It's absolutely free and available every Wednesday at www.blackagendareport.com.
Thank you, Glenn, as usual.
We go now to hear an excerpt of a speech by Phyllis Bennis at the Russell Tribunal on Palestine. This tribunal focused on the responsibility of the United States of America and the United Nations regarding the Israeli breaches of international law toward Palestine and Palestinians. There is now a situation in which Israel has achieved a status of immunity and impunity, facilitated by the U.S., despite its complete disregard for the norms and standards of international law. Phyllis Bennis is director of the New Internationalism Project at the Institute for Policy Studies. She's also a fellow of the Transnational Institute in Amsterdam. She's been a writer, analyst, and activist on Middle East and UN issues for many years.
Again, accepting all of the usual assumptions of Israeli danger by Iran, et cetera, in the middle of an article, there's a reference to Israel's still unacknowledged nuclear weapons arsenal. Whoa. Now, those of you who are not from the United States would say, why is that an issue? Of course there's an unacknowledged nuclear weapons arsenal. The whole world knows that. Yeah, but in the United States, our mainstream media and our government, more importantly, doesn't acknowledge it. We accept, they accept, the Israeli notion of strategic ambiguity as to whether or not they have. No, that's their term. Come on, I didn't make it up. So that's another example. In 2010, when we heard that there was a lot of pressure from the United States against Israel. Now, in fact, there was no pressure on settlements, as we know. But we were being told there was a lot of pressure. Obama is throwing Israel under the bus. Oh my God, what are we going to do? Lots of pressure. There was a poll asking people their view of Israeli settlements. And choice number one said, Israelis are building settlements in the occupied territories for security reasons, and they have the right to build wherever they want. Sentence number two, Israelis are building settlements on expropriated Palestinian land. They should be torn down and the land returned to its original owners. Now, that happens to be accurate, but it's a very provocative way of describing it. 63% of registered Democrats chose sentence number two. That's huge. We don't acknowledge those victories. They have happened because there is a movement demanding an end to the $4.1 billion of U.S. military aid to Israel, imposing BDS requirements. What does that mean in the context of the United States? Well, it means boycotting individual actions, boycotting goods that either support Israeli occupation in the occupied territories or that support the Israeli militarization overall. Lots of different definitions. It means institutions in the United States facing divestment claims when their money is being used, the profits of that money is being used to support occupation and apartheid. And where are we seeing this? The churches. The churches are way out in front of the left and the students and all the rest of us right now on the question of divestment. We have mainstream US churches, the Methodists, the Presbyterians, the Quakers. The Quakers are kind of mainstream on this one because they were late. The Presbyterians and the Methodists were way out in front of the Quakes. I don't know what happened this time. But they all now have voted for strong boycott resolutions. They have all voted for strong resolutions against US military aid. And they have all come very, very close, it'll probably happen the next round, to voting for full divestment. So this is the focus on corporations, US corporations, and corporate policy in this country, as well as the government policy of complete defense of Israel in the United Nations. And this is where the question of the US and the UN come together. Part of it is about the veto, and we've heard a lot about the veto. We heard how 75% of the US vetoes cast in the last, I think it's 20 years, I recommend people to see my colleague David Wildman's incredible article on the veto. I think it's something like 75% of all US vetoes of the last 20 years have been cast to defend apartheid, either in South Africa or Namibia or Israel. That's a huge, horrifying record for a country like ours that claims to be against apartheid. But it's not only about the veto, because it's not only about the Security Council. Despite the fact that the UN General Assembly is by far the most democratic operation, the most democratic agency within the United Nations, one country, one vote. Now, granted, when you have China and India each have one vote, and Vanuatu and the Micronesian Islands each have one vote, it's not exactly democratic. But in the context of states, we'll give them some credit. It's the closest thing to a UN democracy we've got. In the context of the UN General Assembly, we see a massive campaign that works all too often to intimidate, threaten, punish countries for their votes where they don't have a veto. So one example, again, using the example of the run-up to the war in Iraq, There was a memorandum circulated by the U.S. The U.S. mission to the U.N. to every member country of the United Nations General Assembly that said, and I don't remember the exact language, but the gist of it was, there is a move afoot to have another discussion of the situation in Iraq in the General Assembly. We do not believe that that will be a helpful thing to happen. Please note, that was the language, please note that this issue and your position on it is very important to us. Now, you want to take that as a threat? You know, what about your foreign aid? What about whatever? Remember the Yemen precedent of the first Gulf War in 1990 when the U.S. was trying to get a Security Council resolution passed, endorsing, and at that time, George Bush Sr. succeeded to get a resolution endorsing another war in the Middle East. Two countries voted no. Cuba voted no on principle. Yemen, recently reunified, the only Arab country on the Security Council, could not afford to vote to support a U.S. invasion of another Arab country. Yemen voted no. And no sooner had Abdullah al-Ashtalt put down his hand, there was the U.S. ambassador at his side saying, that will be the most expensive no vote you ever cast. And sure enough, 3 days later, the U.S. cut its entire aid budget to Yemen, poorest country in the Arab world. Now, at the time, nobody really cared about Yemen, so they didn't bother to worry that he was caught on an open microphone saying that, and it was soon broadcast around the world, because the issue wasn't really Yemen. It was the message to the rest of the world, particularly to the global south, particularly to those countries newly decolonized who might have the chutzpah to stand up to the United States and say, you know what? Independence means something to us, and we're going to use it. So the question becomes, what do we do to reclaim the United Nations, to reclaim the kind of movement we saw on February 15th of 2003, to remind ourselves of what Bishop Tutu's words to Kofi Annan mean? I don't think it necessarily means that we can realistically plan for street demonstrations that are going to bring 14 million people out into the streets. That may happen, hopefully sooner rather than later. But I don't think that's necessarily the only kind of campaign we can work on. The BDS campaign as a global campaign has played that role of uniting movements across the world, recognizing that while conditions are different in every country and therefore targets are different in every country, some countries are going to focus on sanctions, some on boycotts, some on divestment, some on goods produced only in the occupied territories, others on goods produced anywhere in Israel. Many definitions. It's a broad tent movement, and it has succeeded and is succeeding at bringing together people around the world to say, we take a lesson from the particular anti-apartheid movement that focused on South African apartheid. Israeli apartheid is different, but they are both in violation of the international covenant against the crime of apartheid.
That was Phyllis Bennis speaking at the Russell Tribunal on Palestine. Visit us online at lawanddisorder.org for archived programs and links to many of the issues we discuss.
The United States is the only country in the world that sentences children to life without the possibility of parole. Last month, the U.S. Supreme Court revisited the question of whether juveniles convicted of murder should be given mandatory life sentences without the possibility of parole. The Supreme Court had once ruled against imposing death sentences on juveniles and imposing life sentences on youth who aren't convicted of murder. Currently, 2,500 children in jail are serving life sentences without parole in the United States. 250 of these individuals are in the state of Michigan. Our next guest has been working on a lawsuit on behalf of 9 Michigan individuals who were sentenced to life in prison for crimes committed when they were children and who are being denied the possibility of parole. Attorney Deb LaBelle joins us to talk more about this issue. She's an attorney with the ACLU of Michigan's Juvenile Life Without Parole Initiative. Deb LaBelle, welcome to Law and Disorder. Deb, the Supreme Court 2 weeks ago revisited the whole question of giving juveniles, that's like 14-year-olds, life without parole on 2 cases, and I wanted to ask you your reaction to that.
Well, I've read through the transcripts. I wasn't able to be at the argument, but the first thing that struck me is when the court was talking about juveniles under the age of 18, all but one or maybe two justices didn't use the word juveniles, they used the word children. And so the concept that many of us have been talking about, that these are children under both international law and in U.S. law for civil matters, children are different than adults. The court seemed to readily grasp that. They weren't speaking about juveniles or teenagers or young adults. They spoke continuously about what to do about children who are involved in homicide crimes.
Deb, I'm interested in having our listeners know what the facts of those cases are, because they're relevant to what you just said. As I recall, one was a 14-year-old and one was a 15-year-old or something. And so I was worried when I heard that it might only apply to people of a 14-year-old, and you're saying, well, it's interesting they did children. But what was the actual cases in front of them that they're concerned about?
Right. The court had 2 cases in front of them. Both of them were involving 14-year-olds, one in which the 14-year-old did not commit a homicide but was convicted of either felony murder or aiding and abetting. So he was along for the ride, essentially, and someone else committed a homicide, and the juvenile got mandatory life without possibility of parole because the child was sentenced as an adult, even though he was 14. In the other case, the 14-year-old actually committed the homicide and, again, was sentenced to life without possibility of parole as the mandatory adult sentence. And the court was looking at, really took 2 questions up. One, whether a mandatory sentencing scheme for children, for under 18 even, is permissible, where the court has no discretion to consider the status as a child or the lesser culpability or the unique characteristics of a child for rehabilitation. The court, both the jury and the judge, are bound. But once the child is in front of them as an adult charge, the court must sentence them to mandatory life without parole. And there is a number of states who have that system, my state, Michigan, being one of them and one of the most severe sentencing states. The other question the court took up was whether 14 or 15 or 14 and under, whether that sentencing a youth that young is in of itself unconstitutional, that in any circumstances would it be cruel and unusual punishment to issue that sentence for someone that young, even though they were involved in a homicide or committed a homicide. And so the court had previously in Graham versus Florida said that for under 18, those who were involved in non-homicide crimes, it was unconstitutional under the Eighth Amendment. And now the court's looking at the same type of kids involved but in homicide crimes.
Deb, for overview purposes, 38 states allow children to be tried and punished as adults, correct?
That is correct.
Now, is 18 the age in all of those, do you know?
There is a handful of states, Michigan and I think 8 others, who treat 17-year-olds always as adults for all purposes in the criminal justice system. And then it starts to get under the 38 states, there's a whole range. Some you can only get life without parole if you're 16 and up, 16 and 17. Some allow it for 15. Some states allow it for a child of any age. Michigan is one of them. So a child, and I think one of the justices talked about that, is there an age in which we would all share a collective cringe? What about a 5-year-old? What about a 10-year-old? What about a 12-year-old? And try to force the one of the state attorneys to say, and the state attorney says, well, certainly not 12, and maybe 13, you know. So, you know, is the question whether there is a certain age where it's going to be impermissible punishment, or do we go with the bright line the court's drawn for the death penalty and for non-homicide crimes, which is under 18?
You mentioned the issue of potential for rehabilitation. There's a related issue, and that is that the mind of a child is really not formed, I think, until the early 20s, I've read. What kind of documentation related to that has been submitted in arguing on behalf of changing this policy?
Well, I think that the psychiatrist and the American Psychiatric Association, the AMA, and the American Psychological Association all submitted amicus briefs here and in the former case, saying that the frontal lobe, the area of the brain that really addresses impulse control and, you know, long-term consequences and controls issues of risk management, is not developed. It is developing through adolescence. And people draw the age at different points. They say, well, some not till 19, some not till 23, as you say. But on average, I think that people say that around the age of 18, and I might say young women seem to develop the frontal lobe quicker than young men, but generally there's a bright line that's been drawn in civil law of when youth have a kind of maturity that they can vote, when they can decide to leave school, when they can drink in some places, when they can drive. There are these bright line things that not every child certainly falls into that. Some don't mature to much later. Some would mature earlier. And so the question is, if you're going to draw a bright line, do we draw it at the 18, which has been drawn in terms of civil responsibility issues? Or do we, as Justice Roberts urged in Graham and may urge again, that we at least take youthfulness into consideration so that there's no mandatory system, but you have to take each individual youth and their youthful status into consideration before sentencing?
Michigan Attorney Deb LaBelle, we've been talking about sentencing juveniles to life without parole. Is this unique in the United States? And how many people in the United States and how many people in the state of Michigan or Pennsylvania do we have in prison forever?
It is unique in the United States in terms of states allowing this to occur. Every other country who has either signed on to the Convention on the Rights of the Child, which prohibits putting children in prison for life without possibility of parole explicitly, it has recognized that this practice is banned. The only other country who hasn't signed on other than the United States is Somalia, and they don't have quite a government right now to do that. So we stand alone in not adhering to that Convention on the Rights of the Child, as well as we stand alone in approving this sentence in this country. No one else in the world, no other state in the world approves this sentence. So we have over 2,500 youth who are serving a sentence of life without any possibility of parole in this country. Michigan is number two with 371. Pennsylvania is number one.
And what is the racial makeup of these children?
The racial makeup across of it is predominant, you know, there's a disparate impact. About 70% are children of color. And it's also about a third of them themselves did not commit a homicide.
So it was a felony murder or
aiding and abetting.
Aiding and abetting. I read Justice Ginsburg's quote saying, essentially, you're making a 14-year-old a throwaway person by removing the possibility of hope of release. And I think that beautifully captures what we're talking about here, sort of warehousing young individuals who've made a mistake and really getting rid of one of the old principles of incarceration, which was rehabilitation.
I think that's true, and I think Justice Sotomayor, too, spoke about them having no hope. And in getting rid of the sentence, it's so odd to me because we're really talking incrementally. What we're talking is the relief sought is that you just can't sentence a child to prison for the rest of their life with no hope of release. No one is arguing that there might not be circumstances, at least they're not arguing now in these cases, that a state couldn't decide upon review that that child couldn't be released. But what the argument is you can't keep them in there with no hope. You have to give them a realistic opportunity to demonstrate upon maturation that they have been rehabilitated and that they aren't a threat to public safety.
Deb, this country, as everyone knows, is becoming increasingly draconian in terms of our public officials and the media reporting on, you know, harsh sentencing. I think we've really lost sight of what a punishment and the proportion of a punishment based on factors such as age, whether they were the primary offender in the crime, that seems to be out of control. Do you think there's any hope for reversing this trend nationally?
I think that you're right to say that there's been a really disturbing time period in which we almost see our children with fear, and we don't see them as our future, which is somewhat unique. And, you know, both in school discipline, in which we, you know, harshly punish children and kick them out of educational opportunities if they step over the line, and then the imposition of long-term punishments and placing youth in adult prisons for a very long time and up to life without possibility of release has been really a disturbing trend. But I have to say that when you look at what's happened since the Supreme Court took the stand in 2005 saying, no, we will not execute children, I think that there have been more and more states that have discretion, that judges are moving away from this treatment of youth and moving back to thinking about perhaps, since we do this even in cases of dogs that have gotten vicious, you know, we should think about putting these children in places where we can nurture, counsel, and believe in their rehabilitation and give them a second chance. The states that are mandatory punishments, like Michigan, California, Louisiana, Pennsylvania, Florida, the judges have been unable to make any impact on that sentencing. And in fact, I read transcript after transcript of judges saying, listen, I don't want to do this to this 14, 15, 16-year-old, but I don't have any choice. So I do think that there is starting to be some recognition of how destructive we've been to our youth.
Yeah, I think, as you said, it's an incremental change. It's not that they couldn't keep a juvenile in life in prison for life. It's just that the mandatory issue, at least at this point, is what's before the court. I have a question on where we are, because the Supreme Court said you could not sentence anyone under 18 to life imprisonment. Is that the ruling, or is it more complex than that?
In Graham, they said you could not sentence, they did a categorical prohibition of sentencing anyone under 18 to life without possibility of parole for a non-homicide crime.
Got it.
So
for a not.
If no one died, then you cannot send a youth away for the rest of their life for that.
Right. So the case that was just argued concerns when someone died, whether you could put a juvenile into jail for life. Is that right?
That's
without
correct.
Parole.
Right.
Right. And what about death penalty?
The death penalty was gone for everyone under 18, but in the Roper case in 2005.
Got it. Okay, so go back to where we sort of began this. You said you weren't at the argument, but you read the transcript, and you were making a couple of points, one about the way they use the word children and go through that and how that might affect the outcome, and the second point you wanted to make.
I think the court's discussion of this as children, and also I think that the number of justices talking about both what is the value of putting a child away with absolutely no hope? It's certainly not a public safety issue because that could be addressed by the states having parole or review hearings to determine whether that child is capable of rehabilitation, has been rehabilitated, and can come back, something we do routinely for adults who commit second-degree murder. I mean, that's a standard review process that we all go through in the States. What the question then comes down to, is it ever valid to have this kind of punishment solely for the sake of punishment? Because you're not talking about public safety. You're talking about how long should we punish someone, a child, for an act that they did before they became a mature adult.
That was the question I was going to ask you, Deb LaBelle. Let's say there's a blank slate, and we're going to refashion the law, and we're going to call it the Deb LaBelle law. What would you say? What would be your ideal way of treating children criminals?
One of the things I was curious about when we started looking at this issue in Michigan is how long do adults actually serve if they commit homicide? Because I was curious about that. What kind of punishment do we think is enough for an adult? And so I started looking at, in Michigan, the thousands of adults who were arrested over the last, you know, five decades for first-degree homicide. And we looked at all of them, and we found out that 60-some percent charged with a first-degree premeditated murder took a plea, because that's the way things are done in the criminal justice system. Generally, the majority of people take plea bargains. I think there was a recent article in the Times that if there were no plea bargains, the whole system would crash and burn because we couldn't have that many trials or incarcerations. So then we looked at what did they actually serve. And the adults in Michigan who were charged with first-degree premeditated homicide and took a plea bargain and got out served on average 12.4 years.
Remarkable.
That's
just
stunning.
Remarkable.
12.4 years. And so when the people say adult time for adult crime, I'm like saying, hey, the kids I work with would take 12 years.
Deb, speaking of pleas, how does the recent Supreme Court decision, I think it was Loeffler, impact, if at all, on this issue of life without parole?
Actually, that's pretty fascinating, because what Loeffler talked about was recognizing that plea bargains are a central part of our system of criminal justice. And they looked at when counsel wasn't effective in explaining the consequences of turning down a plea or taking a plea. And so in one circumstance, the individual turned down a plea bargain and then went on to get a much harsher sentence. And they did that because they didn't understand the consequences of turning down the plea. And the Supreme Court has noted that youth in the adult criminal justice system are at a really high disadvantage in terms of they almost always have assigned counsel because they don't have their own resources. Assigned counsel have a lot of difficulty in terms of resources themselves, and kids don't understand the system. So we have over 100 kids in Michigan, for example, who turned down a plea bargain many of them would be out today for the reason that they didn't commit the homicide, and they couldn't understand and did not understand, sometimes their lawyers didn't understand, that if they were convicted, they could get mandatory life in prison without parole, even though they hadn't killed anybody. Kids are at such a disadvantage in terms of understanding that system and in terms of understanding the consequences. I don't know if you guys remember, but I do. If you talked to me about when I was 15, if you had said to me, you know, well, you can go to prison for 15 years, I would have said, like many of the youth that I work with, but I'll be an old man. I cannot conceive of 30. You know, this whole plea bargain, which the court recognizes as an essential part of the criminal justice system, we have found that youth are highly disadvantaged in that whole system.
You mentioned earlier, Deb, the Treaty on the Rights of the Child.
Right.
And a couple of questions. When has the U.S. ratified that treaty? And if so, how do they get away with not abiding by it?
Well, they haven't ratified the Convention on the Rights of the Child, but they have ratified ICCPR, the International Covenant on Civil Rights. And there, they ratified that convention, which says that you cannot put a child in prison except for the least amount of time necessary, essentially, for rehabilitation. And the U.S. government wrote a reservation on that and said, okay, but we want to be able to treat children as adults in exceptional circumstances. And that's the U.S. government. And here, you know, if they were following that reservation, we wouldn't have thousands of kids serving life without possibility of parole. We'd have a few, because you can't say, well, we're going to mandatorily treat, you know, children 14 and up as adults and sentence them to life without parole and say that that's exceptional circumstances. So I actually think many of the states are currently in violation of the convention, which was ratified by the U.S. government.
The convention also prohibits children becoming soldiers at under 18, and the U.S. has a policy of enlisting 17-year-olds, unlike most, I think, unlike other countries that have signed the convention. Did that issue come up in the court argument at all?
That hasn't. You know, that's actually a really fascinating point. It is not.
We're speaking with Attorney Deb LaBelle from Michigan. And Deb, you've got a very important case in the courts there. Can you tell us what you hope to achieve by this case?
Yeah, one of the things that we did here is we filed a civil rights action on behalf of the youth in Michigan, because generally these cases are brought up only on appeal from criminal convictions. And I guess we're not saying the child didn't do what people said they did. We're just saying they're not who they say they are. You know, you can't define them by that act, and that even though they've been convicted of a certain crime, that the sentence itself violates their civil rights because it fails to take into consideration their status as a child. And the court has allowed us to proceed in the first case in the country on a civil rights argument in that way. Instead of requiring us to, you know, challenge a criminal conviction, we've gone directly and made it a claim of a civil rights violation. And one of the fascinating things is it's sort of unique. There's nowhere, I can't quite think of anything else in which courts of law can wave a wand and say, yes, I know you're a child, you're 14, you're under 18, everywhere else you're a child, but I'm going to pretend that your status is as an adult. I'm going to treat you as an adult and sort of morph their status. Everyone else has to be treated consistent with the facts of who they are. What we're saying is that you have to recognize their child status, which is different from an adult. In doing that, it would be cruel and unusual punishment to put you in prison for the rest of your life and not give you an opportunity for release. And, of course, putting a 14-year-old in prison for the rest of your life is the harshest sentence we have in Michigan. If an adult at 50 years old who committed 4 homicides could only get that sentence, and, of course, the sentence would be harsher for a juvenile than that adult, just given the amount of time left in their life.
Deb LaBelle, thank you very much for all your good work and for being on Law and Disorder. Good luck to you on the case, and we'll check in with you and see how it comes out. Thanks for being on the show.
Thank you, Deb.
Thank you both. Bye, Deb. Thanks
Bye-bye.
So much.
If you want to hear Law and Disorder again, go to lawanddisorder.org on the web. You should also go to Law and Disorder Radio on Facebook.